And we will endeavor to understand what has passed and imagine what is to come.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Now, here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello, welcome back to Millennial 2025. I'm now here with Stefan Verstappen, and I've advanced this stream, and now there's going to be another stream at the end of this night with Aidan Paladin. So she was last on, I think, in 2018. So that should be quite interesting. Sam Dixon will just try to reschedule. I don't know. Those technical problems can't be helped. So, Stefan, welcome. This is our first time. It's a debut. So thank you for doing this. And especially thank you for doing it an hour sooner than you were expecting. Welcome to the show. Please introduce yourself to the audience.
Thank you very much for having me on your show. When you first emailed me, I went, Millennial Woes, yeah, I think I've heard of him. And I mentioned it on my live stream when you first emailed me, which was almost 2 months ago, I guess. And I got a lot of messages saying, oh, you got to go on the show. You got to go on Colin's show. It's a great show. And he's got great guests, so you really got it. So the way everybody responded, like, "Oh my God, this guy's a heavy hitter. I better go on the show." But I am honored to be included among your roster of esteemed guests. I love all of them. They're about the only people I still listen to anymore because I've drawn away from the whole truth movement and I've been doing this for a long time. I've been a conspiracy theorist for over 50 years. I mean, I'm happy to see people are finally starting to catch up, but I'm kind of done, you know. I'm very black-pilled, although I do keep positive about things. I don't allow myself to get, you know, completely negative about the way the world is going, but look how it's going. And I still try to remain positive, and I remain positive, most importantly, for my friends, family, and for the kids. You know, we can't just all throw our hands up and say, oh, we're doomed. Well, yeah, we are doomed, but don't let the kids hear you talk like that. I mean, I personally feel worse for the younger generations growing up into this. And even though I'm a boomer, I call it a baby boomer, because I'm at the tail end of the boom cycle. Most boomers are 10 years older than me. But even still, I'm classified as a boomer. And I feel bad for the world we're leaving to young people. I mean, I have had a phenomenal life of adventure and creativity and exploration, and all of that is gone for the kids. Nobody will be able to live the kind of life I lived in this day and age. It's impossible. And so what have we left them? So we got to try and help. We got to try and fix things anyways. So, I guess we can start off at the beginning. I was originally a survivalist, being a child.
Right,
being a child in the 60s, we were inundated with apocalypse porn. You know, there were movies and TV shows and series and books and magazine articles all talking about, you know, the end of the world, nuclear annihilation. And so at the young age of 12, I began to study how to survive this. I mean, everybody seems to be insisting that the end of the world is nigh. So I began becoming a survivalist. And first thing I did was I joined up with what was called an Outward Bound program. This went on for 3 years. And this was the kind of program where they took, you know, young boys and girls, and they taught them how to live in the wild, how to be self-sufficient, how to paddle a canoe, how to rappel down a cliff, how to, you know, make a camp and a campfire, cook a pie in a Dakota fire stove. I mean, it was a wonderful program, and I learned a lot, and it really made me who I am today, because learning all these wilderness skills and going out into the wilderness, it toughens you up.
How old were you then?
12, 13, 14, and 15 was the last year. By the time I was 15, I was already traveling into the bush by myself via canoe. And because I love the wilderness, I love nature. And then I backpacked through Europe the following year alone. And wow, what an experience. So anyways, that's to start. Wilderness survival skills, that type of thing. Then I began studying martial arts. You need to know how to fight, especially with what's coming. You need to be what I now call a warrior. So I started studying martial arts, and I studied martial arts for, well, I guess almost 10 years. And then I moved to China, and I continued studying my martial arts while living in China. I lived there for about 4.5 years, and I studied in Hong Kong, in Taipei, and even in Thailand and South Korea. So I became a martial arts expert. Around the same time, I studied for and became an instructor for St. John Ambulance, which I'm sure you have there in Scotland, right? You're a Commonwealth country, so I think you have St. John Ambulance there, right?
They're the ones with the snake symbol. Or is that the something? I can't remember.
But no, the Maltese cross.
Oh.
Yeah, it's a white Maltese.
Yes. Right? Yes, I've seen those. Yes.
And the upper echelon members get to wear a cape. Like my boss, Pat Robertson, she was 76 when she hired me. We got along wonderfully. I loved that woman. She was fantastic. And she was a WAC during World War II. And so she would march in the Warriors Day Parade in Toronto. I guess you guys have that there too. And she would wear her black cape with the bright white Maltese cross on it. So, well, then, you know, I learned about how to deal with injuries and help people that were in trouble. And I learned anatomy. Oh, that's my alarm. I got to wake up now. But again, it's all part of my survivalist training, right? And so now, I'm good at, you know, handling myself in the woods. I can hike, I can canoe, I can camp, I can build shelters. Then, you know, I learned martial arts because, well, you know, it's the end of the world. We're going to be fighting for survival. And then St. John Ambulance. So now I'm a useful person to have in your community. If something goes wrong, I can treat you. I have a very extensive first aid kit here in the house. And, you know, short of a emergency room doctor, and the next best thing you could hope for if you were in an accident. Then I started taking up, by this time I was 18, as soon as I turned 18, the first thing I did was buy a firearm. Yeah, I'm good with my hands and feet. I've ended up teaching martial arts for about 45 years. I fear no man, but better to have a gun. So I got my went into firearms training, and then I wrote my first book, which is the 36 Strategies of Ancient China, which is along the same similar lines to Sun Tzu's The Art of War. And it's about strategies and tactics, but very practical strategies and tactics, things you could use not just in the military, things you could use in business, and things you can use in politics. So I became a strategist. The whole time, I'm also very interested in history. And one of the books I was reading when I was done, this was when I was like 15 or so, was Isaac Asimov's Foundation Trilogy. That was a great series. What really interested me about that was the premise of that story is that this the main character, the protagonist, studied history and came up with his own algorithm to predict the future. And I thought, well, that's interesting. And he predicted the collapse of his civilization, of the Galactic Empire. And so he started making plans for how people could survive the 1,000-year collapse of the empire. And I've followed that ever since, and I've read numerous books on history, and I've been trying to figure out where we're going. I wrote an essay that was published in Gerald Celente's Trends Journal. I love Gerald Celente, great guy. And the name of the essay is Historical Cycles, Are We Doomed to Repeat the Past? And basically what I did was I took all the theories about historical cycles, the Strauss-Howe theory is just the most recent. There's actually been dozens of famous historians that have done the same, tried to predict the future. And so, excuse me, I also tried to predict the future. And I've come to the similar conclusion that many have come to, and that is Western civilization is going to collapse. So even more reason to become a survivalist, or now they call us preppers. So yeah, we're heading for a collapse, and that we need to get ready. I tell people we're on the Titanic, and it's going down. It's already hit the iceberg. And first thing you need to do is grab a life vest. Now, a life vest is your preps, right? 3 months worth of food, medical kit, firearms, radios. Did I say firearms? Yeah.
Yes.
Radios and so on. Get ready. That's your life vest. But what if this continues for much longer, which it probably will? Then what's the next step? And so again, I researched history. what happened in the past when societies collapsed, you know, after the collapse of the Roman era, or after the collapse of the Han Dynasty. What did people do then to survive? And so that's what brings me to where I am today. What people did to survive is they formed small autonomous communities. Sometimes they were monasteries. Sometimes they were like the Amish, you know, farmer groups. Oftentimes they were mutual aid societies. And so that's what they did. So get prepped, you know, 3 months worth of food, et cetera, et cetera. That's your life vest. But if you need a lifeboat, that has to be a community. I'm almost finished my book, The Complete Guide to Forming Communities for Mutual Aid and Charity. I'm up to 400 pages, but I've been procrastinating so much, I still haven't finished it. Hold on a sec, I'm drying out a bit.
So, to get back to your, I'm curious about your childhood, and I mean, I don't want to pry, but is there anything that you think might have set you up for this suspicion that, the need for survivalism, the need to defend yourself, keep yourself alive, and the conspiracy theories that you mentioned at the start, and also that Western civilization is doomed. All of those seem to be a sense of threat and danger. Yeah. And you are looking for various ways to fortify yourself and strengthen yourself so as to deal with adversity and danger. Were your parents of a similar mindset, or were they very mainstream, conventional? Why do you think you ended up with this mentality?
No, I didn't have any. I was raised by a single mother who was, well, she was a real bitch. And I didn't have any male role models in my life. No father, no grandfather, no uncles. I didn't have any of that family. So it was just me. And I kept waiting for, you know, a man that I could look up to that would mentor me. And I never came across one. So by the time I was 13, I said, well, since there's no men around to teach me how to be a man, I'll teach myself how to be a man. And that's why I went into the Outward Bound program, you know. Can you survive in the woods overnight and not be afraid in the dark of the bears? Then I thought, well, you know, what if, I got into a fight? What if I had to defend the virtue of some woman under attack? What am I going to do? You know, I'm going to just run away and hide, like we've seen that recent video of that guy in Brazil, how shameful. His girlfriend gets attacked by a Negro with a knife, and he hides. No, I could not be like that, right? So that's when I started learning martial arts. And I really took to it because it made you feel masculine, but it also made you feel in control. And, you know, Socrates wrote that courage is the virtue that makes all other virtues possible. And I have to say that's true. Part of the reason we don't see anything getting better in this world is most people are cowards. They are. They won't speak up. They won't stand up. They won't stand their ground. They'll just go along to get along to avoid any kind of conflict. You got to stand up. We are being murdered. We are being destroyed on purpose. And we all know who the special ones, the ones that God loves the most, they're trying to kill us. But, you know, they've been trying to kill us for 4,000 years. I've traced this all the way back. And that's been their whole goal from the very beginning, to destroy Amalek. And somehow, after 4,000 years, Amalek turns out to be all white people. You know, how can you hold a grudge for that long? You know?
Yeah. I don't want to get... Just remember that I'm in Britain and there are hate speech laws here, so I need to be careful about
yes,
my broadcast. But we can speak...
Listen, they just hauled a buddy of mine away here. They picked him up and they threw him in jail for anti-Semitic hate speech. After that, I called my lawyer, who's a member of my community. And I said, Carl, they just hauled a friend of mine away for saying stuff I say every day. I might be next. So I said, he'll come to the jail and help me get out if that happens. He said, oh, yeah, no problem. I'll do it pro bono. Nice guy, but he's a member of our community. I belong to an unbelievably fantastic community. Good people, talented people with skills, and they're all on board. They're you know, they know what you and I know about the world. So, you know, you don't have to tell them anything. Well, they're not quite as up to par on the special ones. That's why I use that term, the special ones. We all know who they are. But they're, you know, back there in 1500 BC or something like that, the Amaleks interfered with their journey to Jerusalem. And now, you know, 2,500 years later, no, 3,500 years later, they're trying to kill me. Like, I'm responsible for that. I mean, these people are insane. They're absolutely, completely insane. But we know that.
Yes. Yes, yes. So let's talk about conspiracy theories. You said you've been a conspiracy theorist for 50 years. Does that mean the JFK assassination, or was there something even earlier than that which took your interest? I mean, I guess 50 years ago, 1975...
No, it was the JFK assassination, because we saw it on the news, and I was just like, I think I was like 6 years old when that happened. So it was on the news cycle all the time. And then a couple of years later, that guy, Dan Rather, I think it was, who was this news host, and he was like the most trusted name in news. And he came out and he said he was one of the first to see the Zapruder film. And he came out and he said, oh yeah, you could see the president's head fling forward. So, you know, because he got shot in the back. And then... in 1975, they showed the Zapruder film on TV. And I watched it. And you saw very clearly his head went back and to the left, back and to the left, right? So that's when I realized that this Dan Rather was a liar. I mean, the most respected name in news in the United States, I forget what channel he was on, ABC, CBS, or NBC. He was a liar. But so was everybody else. Everybody in the media lied about it. I mean, I'm 18. And you see, I know a little bit about physics, especially Newtonian physics. Every action has an opposite and equal reaction. So if he was shot in the back of the head, how come his head went backwards. Impossible. There's no excuse. I remember some newscaster said, oh, well, it was because once the bullet exited the back of the head, it created a blood jet stream that pushed the head forwards. I'm not kidding. Somebody said that. I can't remember when. This was 30, 40 years ago. So, wait a minute. Everybody in media is lying. You know, let's extrapolate on this bit of evidence. There's no way around it. It's like Sherlock Holmes says, eliminate the impossible, and whatever remains, no matter how improbable, must be the truth. Well, the impossible is that all these people could believe that the shot came from behind. That's impossible. Not when you see his head flying backwards from being shot in the front. So that meant everybody on the news was lying. It was being covered up. But wait a minute, let's extrapolate a little bit further. It also meant everybody in law enforcement is in on it. Now, I don't mean they reached out and they got to the average, cop on the street. But everybody, FBI and CIA, if me a snot-nosed 18-year-old high school kid, I wasn't in high school at the time because I had dropped out a couple of years earlier, thank God. If me a snot-nosed kid can figure this out by myself, where's all these, criminal experts and law enforcement officials? How come they can't figure it out? How come nobody has been arrested for that crime other than Lee Harvey Oswald? And then it was all just covered up. So then I realized not only was whoever ordered the assassination controlled the media, number one. Number two, controlled government, controlled the politics. No politician came out. There was nobody running for Senate or Congress that said, and when I get in, I'm going to look into the Kennedy assassination because it's obvious he was shot from the front. No, nothing. Silence. So whatever this power is, controls the media, controls the police, controls the CIA, controls the FBI, and controls the government. But wait a minute. Let's extrapolate further. Not only do they control all those organizations and institutions in the United States, but they control those institutions worldwide, in every country. How come nobody in France, investigative journalist, ever, came up with a story that said, wait a minute, it goes against the laws of physics that his head should be pushed backwards if he's shot in the back of the head? No articles from France. Russia didn't come out with a documentary. Russia didn't call them out. So whoever controls this narrative of the Kennedy assassination told everybody to shut up. Everybody in our country and your country and Europe and Russia and China and you name it, everybody knows not to talk about it. How is this possible? Who is this power? Who has that kind of a reach? Well, it doesn't take too long to find that out. You find out who owns the media and who owns the politicians. So anyway, go ahead.
So what was the, the JFK assassination, it's obvious what happened there. He wanted Israel. Wanted their nuclear weaponry to be monitored, and he wanted to, I think, ban AIPAC and so on. It's pretty clear what happened there. But what was the next conspiracy? The next thing that you were not convinced by? Let's see.
Well, again, it was around the same time I was dealing pot in high school. So I was the high school pot dealer. Great job if you can get it. You're very popular and you make a lot of money for doing next to nothing. So I would go and buy 1 pound of marijuana at a time, and then I'd take it home and I'd break it up into 20 lids, which was a unit of measurement at that time. I don't know what happened to it. It was just under an ounce. And I would go down. So where I went to buy marijuana in bulk was the University of Toronto, U of T, and specifically Rochdale College, which has long since been torn down, but Rochdale College, which was the student housing building. So I would go down there and buy marijuana by the pound, and then, you know, kind of hang around with the college students. I was always the youngest in every group, so I was still about, I was about 16 then. And one of the college students was talking about this conspiracy theory. He says, do you know that the CIA is in Canada doing mind control experiments on Canadians, and that they would feed them massive doses of LSD in order to control their minds?
And this was in the mid-70s, just to be clear.
Yes, mid-70s, when I first heard this story. And I remember thinking, oh, well, you know, listen, I know about JFK, but this is ridiculous. CIA in Canada? What's the CIA got to do with Canada? And mind control experiments on housewives and giving them LSD? I said, oh, this is ridiculous. Most ridiculous conspiracy theory I ever heard. Well, about 4 years later, there was a show on TV here in Canada on CBC, was called, I think it was called The Fifth Estate. And it was sort of like a 60 Minutes style news show. Anyways, it came out that there was this doctor, Ewan McGregor. One of those damn Scots, no doubt. Ewan McGregor, who was chief of psychology or psychiatry at McMaster University here in Montreal. And it turned out that he was indeed conducting mind control experiments on innocent, unknowing Canadian housewives. He was conducting the experiments at the university, at the medical center. And it all came out because news story, because this guy didn't make a secret about it. He routinely published the results of his experiments in the local medical journal. But how many ordinary people read the medical journals? So nobody knew about it. But anybody in the medical institution knew what he was doing. And it was unbelievably horrific. A woman would come into the hospital and complain she was feeling depressed. And they said, oh, well, then you need to see Dr. McGregor. And so then he would take them in and said, yeah, well, it looks like you have a serious... But we have a treatment for that. And then what he would do, he would put them into a medically induced coma. And while they were in a coma, he would give them electroshock therapy. And he would put a helmet on their head that had speakers in the helmet. And then he would play a loop tape through the speakers. Things like, everybody hates you. You're going crazy. There's something wrong with you. So you've got this innocent housewife, unconscious. She's in a coma. She's high on high doses of LSD. No, I've done a lot of acid in my day. And, if it wasn't for the fact that I have a very strong spirit, I could handle it, you know. But if you were unconscious, you couldn't fight against it. So she's on these wild trips on LSD and an electroshock therapy. Are you kidding me? It's barbaric and it's cruel. It is, Colin, it's torture. So he did this on dozens and dozens of men and women that came into the hospital. And most of them were never the same afterwards. They had lifelong psychological problems. But turns out he was funded by the CIA. So I remember thinking, oh my God, that old college student that I spoke to 5 years earlier that I thought was crazy with his wild conspiracy theory, it turns out it was true. As a matter of fact, it was a lot worse than what he had told me. And the entire medical establishment was all in favor of it. He wasn't called out by any of his fellow psychiatrists. I mean, come on, you put a woman into a medical-induced coma without telling her what you're going to do to her. And then while she's unconscious, you torture her with LSD and this, he called it psychic driving by playing this tape. And none of them reported him to the college or the university or filed a complaint that this guy's out of control. So there again. So I remember thinking, well, if this is true, I will never doubt a conspiracy theory outright again, because it's so bizarre. You know, we had the Kennedy, that was bad enough. Okay, you could see it, that people in power had enough power to cover everything up. But this is Canada. This is McGill University in Montreal. It's an esteemed university, and their entire medical staff was in on torturing helpless housewives, for Christ's sakes. And nobody spoke up. As a matter of fact, this, what's his name? McGregor, Ewan McGregor.
Yeah, I've got it. It's Donald Ewan Cameron.
Cameron. Oh, okay. Yeah, sorry. Cameron.
Yeah.
Ewan Cameron. So, as a matter of fact, he was voted president of the Psychiatric Association. I mean, not only did he not get caught and fired from his job and persecuted for torturing these women, but they celebrated him, and nothing ever happened to him. He retired with his fat pension, and that's it. So now I realize that, excuse my language, but we are fucked. I mean, it's bad enough we got the media and the police and the government, but you've even got your own medical association and the universities. They're all part of the same evil scheme. So that's why after that. And now today, I don't bother with conspiracy theories. I've had 50 years of it. I know about just about all of them, but it's true. It's really true.
Yeah, it's once you get into this, it's obviously a huge world of conspiracy. And I imagine that you meet a lot of wacky people and disagreeable people in that world, as you do indeed in fringe politics as well, and a lot of them will be quite nasty. I don't know if you've had bad experiences. It sounds like you have.
No. Nope.
Never. Oh, right. Okay. So you just got tired of it?
Yeah. I just got tired of it. It's...
Right. Okay.
Look, all of this stuff, actually, it poisons your mind. It's Grima Wormtongue from Lord of the Rings whispering in your ear. Oh, people are evil. Everybody's out to get you, and you can't trust nobody, and just look after number one, and I call that Jew world, because that's the kind of poison they produce. Everything in our culture is part of this poison, and so you spend too much time doom scrolling. It's really going to poison your mind, your intellect. You see, these images and these thoughts will embed themselves in your subconscious, whether or not you're watching it going, oh, I'm just watching this to figure out the conspiracy behind this, and, you know, I could keep a distance from it. Yeah, but you can't, because it goes through. It goes through your filters, and it lodges in your subconscious. And, you know, that's with everything. You know, that's with porn. That's with horror movies. You know, they say by the time the average person reaches adulthood, they've probably witnessed, you know, like 200,000 murders recreated in movies and TV, right? At least. How many times? You know, and all those horror movies. It gets into your head. And I think doom scrolling, especially now, well, for me, look, I've heard it before. I've already seen it. You know, I dealt with this, you know, 40 years ago. I don't need to see it anymore. I don't need one more conspiracy theory. I don't need to know who killed Charlie Kirk. I don't care. You know, I don't need to know if Candace Owens is, you know, one of the good guys. Like, you know, I'm not interested anymore. I follow almost nobody except the people that you have on Millennial, you know, Sam Dixon and Red Ice and Renaissance, American Renaissance, Jared Taylor. I love those guys. So I'll follow them, but I don't follow anybody else. And I don't deep dive anymore into, you know, who did what, you know, October 10th and this and that. Look, I already know it's going to be the special ones behind every one of these conspiracies. Is it real? Is it not real? Who can tell? With AI, you can't even tell anymore. So how am I going to differentiate? I can't. So I just don't deal with it. Instead, I focus on what I'm doing. Because, listen, here's what I figured out. So we know who it is. And we know they're trying to genocide the white race. And they're doing a great job. There's only about 8% of us left now in the world. And the more they bring in the third world psychopaths, the more of us will die. So what's important? What's important, and this is why I do what I do, what's important is for the white race to survive, to not become extinct. That's what's important. If we can hang on another 10 years, I think we'll be okay, but we're very close now to being completely wiped out. And so that's what I work on. First of all, become a prepper, you know, because they're going to pull the plug. And all they have to do is turn off the light switch. Within 2 months, the dead will be piled three stories high on every street corner in America and the world. I mean, people won't last a month without power. And that's all they have to do. Pull the plug on it for a month. You'll be tripping over the dead bodies because most people will not survive. will starve to death or they'll dehydrate. If there's a few still alive, then they'll be at each other's throats, fighting for what limited resources they could scrape together. Look, we got to survive this because according to my essay on historical cycles, we have four stages. We have the hero stage, and then we have the intellectual stage, and then we have the merchant stage, and then you have the stage of chaos. That's where we're going. We're at the end of the merchant stage now, and we're heading into the age of chaos. We already see it happen. It's pretty obvious how chaotic things are becoming. But after the age of chaos, it cycles back around to the beginning. Then comes the age of heroes. That's when the people that survive the chaos, the good, decent people, they start to rebuild civilization. And they rebuild it according to warrior principles. That's why it's often called the warrior age. So once this all collapses and the you-know-whos, you know, manage to rob us all blind, those that survive will find themselves in a new era, an era where all this other stuff is gone, and they have to rebuild. And but that will be a good time. That's when virtue comes back and people rebuild and work together. Listen, it's on the dead bodies, millions of people. Make no doubt about it. It's going to be millions of dead following this age of chaos. What I'm trying to say is for my fellow white brothers and sisters, let's not you be part of the dead. Let you be part of the living that survive long enough so that you can rebuild the world and make it once again a glorious civilization for your children. So,
why? Of course, and we'll get back to that. But why do you say that we need to survive the next 10 years, and that we'll probably be okay if we can do that? Obviously, that's an approximation. But why? Sure. What do you think is going to happen in the next 10, 15 years?
Well, I think they're going to pull the plug on us. Listen, we know they want us dead. The vaccine was a trial run for mass murder. So, listen, if they're willing to do this vaccine thing, what aren't they willing to do? Also, when you read about any of the communist revolutions, you don't want to be alive after the communists get complete control, because the communists always go into sadistic cruelty and evil on a scale unimaginable. And we're already 3/4 of the way into communism already. So I wouldn't put anything past. There is no red line for these people. There's nothing they wouldn't do. And so, in one way, people are becoming more aware of the elephant in the room. It might be hastening our own destruction. If they feel threatened, they'll just pull the plug. How will they do it? Cut off the food supply? They're already doing that. Spray chemicals into the sky. Now it's a white powder. Tomorrow it's anthrax. Who knows? Or even easier, they make the phone call to the power stations and they say, just like in that movie, um, shut it down. And if they turn off the power, that's it. No food, no money, no gasoline, no electricity, no internet, no cell phone. What are people going to do? Now, I'm ready, and the people in my community are ready. We're already prepared for what to do. But how many people are prepared on a level like my community and myself? We're only about 3%. 3% of the population that stand a chance of living through that. And they just have to keep the power off for 6 months. Even less, but let's say they keep it off for 6 months. You know, 3/4 of the world population will be dead. And then they can turn the power on and send in their special weapons and troops and take over everything. So would I put it past the people that control this society to do that? Not at all. So we got to survive what's happening now, which already is hard enough with the mass inflation and immigration and the attack on the healthcare and the attack on farmers. And, you know, we got to survive that already. And that's a lot to survive. People are dying out there. Now that it's winter, how many people freeze to death in the street? I mean, you can't sleep out in the minus, you know, 20 degree weather. How do you stay warm? And so, and already people can't afford groceries, can't afford healthcare. So, yeah, already it's a struggle to survive. And it's only going to get worse unless I don't see any sign of things getting better.
See, it seems to me that their long-term plan is not to kill us, and not to get rid of us by killing us, but get rid of us by convincing us either not to have white kids. Convincing us not to have white kids, yeah. Either by encouraging us not to have any kids at all, or by encouraging us to have mixed race kids. So. Yeah. So the next generation, and then, of course, the next generation, there will be even fewer whites relative to the mixed race and the non-whites. Yeah. And so they'll be even more likely to race mix. With each generation, it gets more and more. And that's a way of getting rid of us that wouldn't would appeal to white women. It would appeal to the kind, open-minded instincts of white women, especially young white women. And it would avoid a backlash. It would avoid us going ape, which, you know, trying to kill us off would. So in other words, they can peacefully annihilate us just by encouraging dysgenic social trends. Don't have kids, be gay, be childless for the climate, or race mix. And then at the end of that, let's say 50-year period, there's just, or certainly 100-year period, there just won't be any white people left.
Yeah. Well, I liken it to ancient Egypt 4,000 years ago. Ancient Egypt, the demographics of Egypt around 2000 BC would have been like modern-day Sweden or Norway. They were white, blonde, redheaded, blue-eyed, and look at Egypt today. You don't know what it is.
Yeah, it's apparently modern. it was genetically closest to modern-day Anatolia. As far as I know, that was what ancient Egypt was closest to today. Yeah, and you can see Anatolian people. I'll see if I can get a decent photo up. West Anatolian Turks. Apparently that is what ancient Egypt looked like. Yeah. I don't know if it was even more Aryan Nordic than that. Maybe
it was more Nordic than even modern day Anatolian. See, modern day Anatolian has already been heavily race mixed
So, yeah, because of Islam and other things. But there's no doubt. I mean, you're right about the ancient Egyptian mummies. We know that they were blonde. We know definitely that they were. I've definitely heard that some of them were redheads. So there's no way that was a black civilization.
Right.
Of course it wasn't. And it wasn't Northern African either, like in the way that we think of now. It was something that's just extinct now. It's just gone.
And so when you see modern day Egyptians, this sort of mud race of Arabs and Negroes and assorted riffraff. I mean, they're an ugly people, the Egyptians. And that's what we'll look like in 50 years. And of course, you know, it's the Kalergi plan, called Olvan Kalergi, destroying Europe by mixing the races. He was also the founder of the European Union, which I don't know about anybody else, but when I first heard that story, I went, no, this is a very bad idea. I've been through Europe many times, traveled all throughout Europe, and I love Europe, or I did. It was beautiful. You know, you want to see Paris in the early 70s, you know, and then compare that to today. It's like night and day. So, you know, they're already destroying it with their Kalergi plan. And, yeah, that's part of it, too. But, again, I'm not sure they won't make it worse. And they could, at any time, make it worse. But either way, we have to struggle. So all the problems that we face can be solved actually very easily, like all those problems, by working together and forming communities. And this is what I've been doing. We've got a community here where I live in Oxford County by the River Thames near London. This part of Ontario is all named after Britain. It's funny. And, but our community is fantastic. We've got, we're building like a parallel society, like an earlier guest of yours mentioned about the need to build parallel societies. And that's what we've done. So what we tried to do is find a backup for all the things we rely on modern society to provide for us. So number one is food. One of the first reasons this community was started was because during the lockdown, the pandemic, people couldn't get into the grocery stores at first. They locked down the grocery store. They wouldn't let you in. Or let us see your vaccination certificate. And me and many other people said, yeah, well, F you. You and your vaccination certificate. We don't need your grocery store. And so we started reaching out to the local farmers. We're fortunate that I live in a rural area, a small town in a rural area. Around us are a lot of Amish and Mennonites. And talk about a survival plan. Follow the Amish. Do what they do. They're brilliant. And they're not some weird...
Huh? They didn't suffer from COVID.
No, they didn't suffer from COVID. And they don't have autistic kids either. Because they avoided all vaccines. So many members in our community are farmers, were farmers, but certainly they know the local farmers. So that's the first thing we did. We approached the local farmers and started sourcing our food from them. You know, F the grocery store. You're not going to let us in unless we get this lethal injection. No, we don't need you. So that was the first thing. And that was our community is divided into teams. So, you choose what team you want to be on. It's very open. There's no pressure. But one of the teams was the nourishment team. And so we began growing gardens. We had three very large gardens spaced out across the county in people's front yards that let us use the front yard to grow gardens, people that had greenhouses. And so that's one of the first things we did. Then we had local farmers that would grow chickens for us. Because we go to the farmer and say, we'll buy 100 chickens. Can you grow us 100 chickens? Free range, you know, at least those chickens had a happy life while they were alive, you know, not in these factory farms, which I just test. Those industrial chicken farms, horrible, horrible, the cruelty to those poor animals. So we got to see them, you know, they're out in the field, running around, having a good time until the time comes for the dinner table. But we buy 100 chickens at a time, and no antibiotics, no growth hormone, you know, just clean, healthy chickens, and that had a decent life while they were still alive. And also, of course, we got the eggs from the farmers. Then we did this is part of a mutual aid society. We'll do this. My adopted daughter, Dixie, whom I'm always singing the praises of, wonderful woman. She's what you would call a forest farmer. She's fantastic at growing food. So she grows a lot of food in her backyard. So we got all these gardens. Everybody, individual members, had, in addition to the communal gardens, they, most of them have their own backyard garden. And they all keep chickens. So we got lots of eggs. And many of them raise rabbits. So that's another source of protein. But what Dixie did, she started a very common type of mutual aid society, which is a bag and box club. Now, bag and box club, one way to survive the inflation and the high prices and to be able to afford groceries is to form a buying group. So you get people that work together, you pool your money, and then you buy in bulk at a discount. So a bag and box is like this. There is a farmers distribution co-op nearby in our county where all the local farmers will sell their goods and their produce through the co-op. And because they'll make more money selling through the co-op than they will selling through the grocery stores, because grocery stores, they take a huge cut of everything. And so the way it works is this. The farmers co-op has a website, and all the farmers that want to sell their goods and wares will put it up on the website. And you can go to the website and shop for what you want, and they've got everything. They got pork, they got beef, they got sausages, they got cheese, they got milk, you name it. They got all kinds of stuff there. You put in your order, and what they'll do is they will deliver it to your house. So this co-op will deliver it. Here's the key, though. Minimum order is $500. All right? So long as you order $500 worth, they'll pick it for you. They'll put it in boxes, and they'll drive it to your house. So what we do is they order through the website. They give the order to Dixie, and we sell them as like $50 boxes. So $50 is not too bad, but we got 10 people each put in $50. That's our $500. So what they would do is they would, the truck would come, they would drive to Dixie's house. They would put all the stuff on her balcony, on her porch. And everybody that ordered something, just go over to Dixie's house and pick it up. So every 2 weeks we would do that. So now you're getting groceries at a fraction the cost of what you would have to pay if you went to the grocery store. It's wholesale, basically. And the best part is, it's all locally grown. Everything comes from local farmers. So now you're getting healthy food. All you have to do is, you know, kick in $50 once every 2 weeks. You can buy more, but $50 the minimum order for members of our community. And then we'll put your order in with everybody else's order, and then just go over to Dixie's house. Tuesday night at 7 o'clock, the delivery is coming. Everybody meet there. Bring your own grocery bags, and that's it. That's how it's run. So, you know, one of the ways to survive is to source your own food separately from the usual channels of distribution. So that's one thing we do.
That's very impressive. It's cool. And as you say, it's all locally sourced, so it's even better.
It's even better. Great. So you're supporting the local farmers. They're happy with us. They like us. Now, shit hits the fan and everybody's starving. Do you think we could go to those local farmers and say, remember us? We're the ones that always order from you. Do you have any extra eggs this week? Right? Of course they're going to help you out. You know, my parents survived World War II in Holland because my grandfather, who I never met, he died during the war. My grandfather was a tax assayer for the Dutch government for the agricultural business. And what he would do, it was his job to go in to the farms and see how many, you know, how much crops they were able to harvest this year. And then they would tax him based on that amount. But he was a decent guy. Everybody said he was a decent guy. And so what he did was he would underestimate what they were harvesting. So their taxes went way down. And the farmers never forgot. And when the war broke out, World War II, they told them, if you need food, you come to us. And that's what happened. So while Europe was starving, and at the last 2 years of the war, most Europeans were starving, my uncles, who were just teenagers at the time, would walk out into the countryside to the farmers, and there they would get, you know, sausage and a loaf of bread and a dozen eggs and big box of cheese. And that's how my family survived World War II. So it's a really good idea to get to know and make friends with the local farmers. And because we're helping them now, right? It's not a crisis. We're helping them. We're, you know, I'd rather see my money go directly to the farmer than to take a side trip through the banks and the grocery stores and the distributors. So they'll remember us, and they know us by name. And so no matter how ugly things get, there's always a good chance that we'll be able to find something, maybe some butter, some milk, some eggs, a couple of chickens, we'll be able to get by. So that's another thing that I always recommend is make friends with your local farmers. I have, I teach people what I call the cookie strategy. And that is you go to the farmer's market. Everywhere there's farmer's markets, right? And what you do is you bake a bunch of really good chocolate chip cookies. And you put three in a little brown paper bag. And then when you go to the farmer's market, and you buy some produce, you give the little bag of cookies to the farmer that's standing there selling you the produce and tell him, this is why, my way of thanking you. I said, within 2 months, everybody at the farmer's market will know you as the cookie lady, right? They'll know you, right? And of course, you're going to take their business card and say a few words and get to know them. And then when shit hits the fan and there's nothing left in the grocery stores, you can call up the farmer from the farmer's market and say, yeah, do you remember me? I'm the cookie lady. Do you have any extra eggs? You know, and believe it or not, I've already had people that responded since I came out with that strategy, and they said, you're right, I'm already known as the cookie man. People at the local farmer's market recognize me right away, and they know who I am, and they all call me the cookie man or the cookie lady. It works. Get to know people, you know, but the key is you give them something free first. You don't wait until you're starving and then you show up at their front porch and demand eggs, right? We got to lay these connections now while, you know, before it gets too bad. Once it gets really bad, then nobody's going to want to deal with you if they don't already know you.
Yeah. It's about creating goodwill in advance of a crisis.
Yeah.
So that's about food. What about, I'm thinking about the other necessities of life. That would be water and electricity. I'm guessing that you've approached these problems as well.
Yes, I've approached those problems. So, well, electricity, well, you're going to be without electricity. But my neighbor, Dixie Sussman, they all just live 5 minutes from me, just down the street here in this small town. He's got a generator. And just across the river, it's another member of our community. He's the captain of the communications team. He's got a generator. I've got a battery pack, one of those, you know, yeah, battery banks. So I can charge my small devices. I can charge my tablet, I can charge my phone, I can charge my rechargeable batteries for the radio, for the flashlight, for the headlights. So I can recharge all the stuff I need to recharge if the power goes out. And this is sustainable for probably a year or two. So I'm okay. I have books. It's called my survival library. What I've done is I've collected PDF books. There's about 350 of them. And it's on everything you could possibly need to know to survive a collapse and even rebuild the world from scratch. It's got everything in there. And there are dozens of plans to build wind generators, hydro generators. So there's all kinds of possibilities of maintaining electrical power. And what was the other thing you said?
Water.
Water, yeah. Well, water is a problem for everybody, but it's not a problem for most people in Canada. Canada's got nothing but lakes and rivers everywhere. And I live 5 minutes from the Thames River and 5 minutes by bicycle. And I already have numerous ways of purifying water already ready to go. Water filters, water for purification tablets. And I also have a 5-gallon still, which I will use to make distilled water, which I will barter if I need to. And I will also use to make spirits. So there's my cottage industry if shit hits the fan, I will make moonshine. And during a collapse scenario, everybody will want a drink. Especially those of Scottish ancestry.
So, well, I'm Dutch.
You're Dutch?
No, I mean you. Dutch people as well are amenable for a drink.
Let's face it, everybody is, right? So now I've got my water, but I've also got a cottage industry that I can use to barter. Listen, that's how the whole whiskey rebellion worked, because those poor Appalachian farmers, there was no money out there. So they would buy and sell using a jug of moonshine as the exchange. And so when the U.S. government made it illegal for them to distill moonshine, that was actually destroying their economy. And that's why they rebelled, not because, they were worried about not having enough to drink. It was because, you know, that's how their economy worked. Here's a Mickey of moonshine, and I'll sell it to you for a pound of butter. That's how their economy worked. And when things get bad enough, that's how the economy will work again. It's a black market. We prepare to go into a black market economy. So water, again, it depends on where you live. Here in Canada, nobody's worried about water. You got to be worried about purifying it, right? So the Thames River, I wouldn't drink it straight out of it. But if you were to filter it and then, maybe add some chlorine, a couple of drops of chlorine, or just boil the water and filter it again. So plenty of water. And I've got, I already bought, like those giant plastic jugs to carry water in. They collapse when they're empty, and then they open up to a big square. So I've got two or three of those, so I can, carry 20 gallons of water. I'm kidding. I'm getting a little bit too old to carry 20 gallons of water. But this is possible, right? So you can get the water and make sure you've got ways of purifying it already, stashed in your house. And like I said, I can distill the water. So I could take raw sewage and turn it into drinkable water. I wouldn't do that, but you could with a distiller. And I can, start working on a small cottage business to bring in money by distilling moonshine. The other thing, too, is you got to get your kids out of school. School is a horror. Do not send your children to public school. And so in our community, guess what? They all homeschool.
Right.
We've got four families in they all live about 10 minutes apart by car, if that. Total of about 15, 20 kids, and the mothers take turns homeschooling everybody, right? So it's not like nowadays people say, I can't homeschool because I can't stay home from work, and who's going to look after the kids if I'm working? And yeah, that's done on purpose. No wonder two parents have to go to work in order to survive. They don't want anybody staying home with the kids. But if you work with a group of people, and they all know each other, and they all trust each other, we're all on the same page. So this family will look after the kids on Tuesdays. This family will look after the kids on Wednesdays. Everybody will come together on Saturday. And so it's homeschooling. And keep them out of school. And those kids actually learn something beneficial. The kids that have been homeschooled, They're wonderful kids. No behavior problems. None of this nose ring, green hair stuff. I mean, they're just good, healthy kids. Really nice. Yesterday, Dixie also grows her own marijuana. She grows like 16-foot tall plants. She's got pounds and pounds of marijuana, so I get all my pot for free. Isn't that nice? And so I called her up. I said, I'm out. It's cold. I don't feel like bicycling down to your house. Can you drop by and bring me some pot? Oh, yeah, no problem. You know, I said, if you're out and about. So she came by, and she brought me, big bag of pot. And one of her kids was in the car, Odin, a boy. And Odin says to me, he says, are you coming for Christmas dinner this year? And I said, well, do you want me to? He says, yeah, we want you to come for Christmas dinner. And I'm not saying that just because I want you, the Christmas presents you bring. And I thought, he's like 8 years old, right? And I thought, see, that's a white person. Only a white person could put themselves in your position, you know, empathetic to say, yes, I'd like you to come, but maybe you're thinking I'm saying that because you always bring Christmas presents, which I always do, and I always carry those little chocolates from Halloween in my backpack. So every time I go to visit any of the families, the kids always come running. Do you have any chocolates today? Well, yes, I do. Here you go. And then you do the grandfather trick of, I pull the chocolate from behind your ear. It's magic, you know.
Right.
So the kids love it, you know.
Are you a sort of beloved elder for the kids?
Well, that's what I'm, exactly. That's my role in this community. I'm everybody's second grandfather. Most of them don't have a grandfather anyways. But, I'm there with a joke and with a magic trick and with a little chocolate candy for everybody. I still have it. I get the chocolates. And I also carry dog treats for the doggos. So when I go to visit any of the families around here, the kids are running, hey, it's stepping, ooh. And then the dogs are going, woo, 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 because they know they're going to get a dog treat. Like I said, it's part of, doing something for somebody else first, without expecting an immediate return. So that's what I mean. Nice kids. Oh, my God. When I was in the hospital, I had a sort of a heart thing happen this time last year, and I was in the hospital for a week. And when I came out of the hospital, my apartment was cleaned because I leave keys to my apartment with Dixie, and I got the keys to their house. So if anything goes wrong, and I need to go over to their house and see how the kids are, I got the keys to get in. Also, they got the keys to come into my apartment. So I come back, holy shit, the whole apartment is clean. And it was dirty. Because I wasn't feeling good, and I sort of let things get run down. And one of the girls that helped clean up the house was, again, one of the girls from the homeschooling. The daughter of our medical team leader, Sheila, and her name is Isabel. She was like 17. What a sweet girl. They don't have that nasty attitude that young people have, where they're always pissed off because they've been hard done by for some reason. And she came over and she cleaned. She helped clean my apartment, her and her mom and Dixie and Kevin. They cleaned my apartment. So I recently started getting a pension from the United States from my deceased wife, who is ex-CIA and part of the Monarch programming. And so I had a little bit of extra money. So because I couldn't afford Christmas presents last year, what I did is, as soon as I got this pension in June, I bought Christmas presents. Well, no. I put cash in a red envelope, which is the Chinese way of doing things, you know. It's called Hongbao. It's a red envelope. So I put cash in it. So I gave Isabel $150 cash. And her mother, Sheila, and I said, thanks for cleaning my apartment. Here's $150. I know it's 8 months late, and they didn't expect anything. You know, it's not like they knew I was going to give them money, but I did anyways, because I love them. They're great people. So this is the thing, what I mean with the community. We also have a medical team. We've got two herbalists, and Sheila is the leader. She can take you for a walk into the local forest and point out all the plants you can eat and all the plants that are good for to make into medicine. And she can make extracts and tinctures and teas from these plants. And she treats people that are sick. And because of my St. John experience, I taught everybody in the community basic first aid. So now everybody in our community has got first aid knowledge, because I would put on the classes. Part of what we do is we exchange knowledge. So if you want to know what medicinal herbs are growing right at the end of your driveway, you wouldn't believe it was medicinal, but there it is. And then Sheila would, 2-3 times a year, say, we all meet at the park at 11 o'clock, and I'll take you for a walk, and I'll point everything out. So now everybody in the community knows how to forage food from the wilderness, right? So two birds with one stone, medicine and food. And in addition, we have three nurses, two physiotherapists, and one Chinese medical doctor, and three other army medics. That's our medical team. We got 15 people. And if you get injured, we can treat you. And what we did is we raised money. We built three robust first aid kits. And they are stationed at different people's houses throughout the county. So if you get sick or you get injured, you know, you go there, David's got the medical kit, he's got training, and go there, and they're going to look after you. And that's what happens. So our medical needs, and I'm not kidding when I say that Sheila's skills are so amazing. And I know it sounds like a big claim to make, but she's cured people with cancer just with medicinal herbs. She knows which ones, you know, the stage 4 prostate cancer. And he took the tincture for 6 weeks, completely gone, completely gone. This is after the doctor said, you're dead. So there's a lot of things that she can treat between her and everybody else. Like, we got 15 people. So we say, okay, so Bob's got, you know, this condition. What do we do? And everybody puts their heads together. I would trust that more than I would trust going to a hospital these days. Because you don't know what they're going to do to you at the hospital. And you don't know if these people are competent. So I would...
Especially nowadays with all the mass immigration and affirmative action and medical qualifications, all the rest of it.
Yeah. So I
and put then COVID course, as well.
As Sheila puts on the medicinal herb course, the nurses put on a home nursing course, how to look after people in your home. So that's that. We also have like the most amazing communications team. First of all, everybody has a ham radio. Everybody. And almost all of them now have their ham radio license. And so we know how to get in touch with people, our people, throughout the county. And a few of us, not me, but for example, Dave, who's the captain or the leader of the communications team, he went out and he bought like a 50-watt base station, and he set up a 40-foot tower antenna, and he knows other people because the community, he gets to know other people as well, and he knows the people that run the repeaters. And now you can get on your little ham radio and you could talk to people in Scotland.
God, that's amazing.
It's amazing. Go ahead.
Yeah. What you're illustrating is that it's actually not that difficult to set up a self-sufficient community. You've got, well, especially not in Canada with the water. The water's kind of taken care of.
Yeah.
But in elsewhere, you could collect rainwater and you've got the filters and all that readily available. So the water, the food, medical supplies and expertise, and then the real difficulty is electricity. But then there are ways around that as well. I mean, like the Woodlander has got his own generator and so forth.
Yeah.
So it's actually, there actually isn't, and then the homeschooling, of course, the Arota, so that everyone shares that burden. So there's actually not that much involved. There's not that much of a struggle involved in breaking apart from the system.
No. At least it's backup for now, okay? For now, it's backup. Sure, still going to use the grocery store. I'm still going to get the water out of the tap. But if suddenly that all disappears, we're not helpless. We've already got backup contingency plans for all of it. And then the final area that we have is security. There's a few of us guys, myself included, I'm on the security team. For example, I did a workshop on, and I taught the entire community, cane fighting. The cane is one of your best weapons. It's legal. It's very effective against knives and personal attacks. And you can carry it everywhere. You won't be stopped by the police. You just, like I tell them, fake a limp. You know, at my age, I can fake a limp and carry a cane everywhere. So I taught cane fighting. Everybody also got a stun gun. Actually, it's a cattle prod. So everybody has some kind of a weapon. You know, this is kind of, too, we have stringent laws against weapons, and you're certainly never allowed to use a weapon to save yourself. Oh my God, no. Yeah, you know, one guy here got invaded. Some guy broke into his house at 3 o'clock in the morning and he got up and he stabbed the guy. He had a knife. Well, he went to jail. You can't defend your property, even though this guy broke into his house at 3 o'clock in the morning. But a stun gun, well, you can't use that for self defense, but you know, if we're having problems, then the stun gun, go ahead, stun the bastard, right? Also, what I've done recently, I've altered our security strategy slightly, and that is I've created a squad. So a squad is a four-man team. It's the most effective fighting force in the military is a squad. So now I've got me and three other guys. We all live within 5 minutes of each other. And everybody's got a firearm. You know, I've got my shotgun. I've got a pistol. My other friend has a hunting rifle, a 308, and a pistol. and a 22. And my other friend also has a 22. So if it's the end of the world, right? Shit hits the fan. Mobs of migrants are coming out of Detroit, sweeping through the countryside, robbing, raping, looting, and murdering. We got four guys that are heavily armed. Most of them have military background. And we've got communications. So we get on the walkie-talkie. You know, there's a bunch of people out in front of Dave's house looking to break in there. We'll show up there 10 minutes later. And we'll come up on them from behind. A couple of warning shots from a shotgun. Most of them will run for the hills. So we've got that taken care of too, right?
Yeah. Like, that's great. It sounds like you've really achieved something here. So it's impressive.
I'll send you the link to the video I made on our community.
Right, okay.
We have to do things like Meals on Wheels, if somebody's sick, and, you know, who wants to volunteer to bring a dinner to, you know, Susie down the street? We'll bring her a dinner on Tuesday. We'll bring her a dinner on Wednesday. Also, we support each other's business. You know, mom and pop shop. We'll do our shopping there. We've got a lady, a wonderful lady, Vivian. I love her. She loves me too. She's like a, you know, your grandmother. She bakes cakes. And she has a Roadhouse restaurant that we've used many times to host workshops. She refused to close down during the COVID lockdown. And the government here in Canada threw its full weight on her to shut down. And they charged her and fined her $50,000 for not closing down her restaurant. Guess what? We just had a fundraiser for last week. You know, we support our local businesses and people. We had other people come to speak for our community, such as Nurses for Freedom. These were the nurses that refused to go along with the lockdown, and they were persecuted. And so they sent a couple of speakers. And then what we do is we pass the hat around. Let's support the Nurses for Freedom. We raised $1,500 for them, you know. So
this
is what we got to do. This is how we stick together. We support people like us, whether they're a member of our community or not, doesn't matter. You know, if you're a good person, then you're fighting the right fight, the good fight on the side of truth and goodness. We'll try and help you. We'll raise money for you. If you're running for government, like one of our guys, I already told you, Carl, he's a member of the provincial government, and it's a special party called the Freedom Party. You know, so we'll pass the hat around, raise some money for his campaign. We'll vote for him. We'll put out posters and lawn signs. We have another group called the political group, and they go to all the local meetings for local government, because that's where a lot of this bullshit comes from, you know, local bylaws and crap that, you know, squeeze the life out of you. So they will attend the meetings, and they'll encourage people to vote against whatever evil scheme they have. So it sounds easy, but it's really hard. Very few people are able to put such a group together. But the amount of good it does is exponential. You know, we help everybody, and not just ourselves. We help other people in the community that live here, like this woman and her children, Lisa. She's a volunteer. She runs the local food bank. So we help her. She's not directly connected to our community, but because she runs the food bank, we'll go around and make sure that everybody in our community, you know, donates a couple cans to the food bank. Although you can't do that anymore because the Pajits and Negroes will come there and clean the place out. But before the Pajits and Negroes, but she still runs the food bank. But it's so bad with these immigrants. They ruin everything.
Yeah, I there are stories like that from all over Europe now as well, stealing stuff from food banks and farm shops as well.
Yeah.
I want to wrap up now because I think it's been good, but I'm conscious that I've got my next guest is waiting. There are a few super chats. The Wanderer said that the district attorney of Orleans, Jim Garrison, believed that JFK was done over by the CIA or FBI. So that's at least one person in government who spoke out. And he also asks if you've heard of the AMARO. It was a story going around in the 90s and 2000s of America integrating with Canada and I don't know what flag that is. But okay, I'll skip that. Wanderer, I hope you don't mind.
Yeah, that's okay, because I don't know about that.
AMARO? Right, okay.
Yeah,
no, AMARO. AMARO, yeah. He also asks, is your surname Dutch or German? I think we've established that it's Dutch.
Dutch, yes.
And then there's a... what was that? From Maple Sven. Says, keep up the great work, Woz. I'm Canadian, and I've never heard of this guy before. I wish he hadn't spiked his eggnog before the interview.
No, I'm drinking beer.
Right. Okay.
Is my speech slurred?
No. I think he's just joking. Okay, well, excellent. Let's end it there. This has been a very interesting and offbeat interview, and we've talked about your background and several conspiracies, and then survivalism, homesteading, and so forth. So, thank you very much. It's been interesting.
You're very welcome, Colin. Thanks for having me on. It's been an honor and a pleasure. And like I said, let's just survive a little bit longer. But in order to survive, you need plan A, plan B, plan C. And plan A is being prepped, and plan B is finding people, like-minded people. Because I can't tell you all the wonderful things that have happened to me. You know, we have potluck dinners, we have music night, we have bonfires, we have Christmas dinners, and that's for the kids and everybody. I mean, you really get a sense of family and community. You know, when I was in hospital, everybody came to visit me and they cleaned up my apartment. And, you know, who does that for you these days? Who does that? Where do you find people like that? Now, I have to say it's because it's rural. It's really hard to get a group of people like that together in a big city. Not impossible, but it's much more difficult. But if you can do that, it's made me personally very happy. I have family now. I have friends. And I have people I trust. Wow. And they'll do things for me. And I'm happy to do for them. So, mutual cooperation. And I tell people, start with just two or three other people. Right? One other family. And then you can start simple. And say, listen, do you guys want to pool your money? We'll buy groceries in bulk and get a wholesale discount. Let's do that first, you know, because look at the prices. Nobody can afford to eat anymore. Let's do that first. Start small with something. Or there's a lot of old people. They live by themselves. If they were to have a heart attack, it would take days or weeks before somebody would find the body. So another thing we do is we have what's called a check-in club. And that's all you do is you have a few of these people, you call them once every other day. Hey, Bob, how you doing? Everything all right? How's the medication? Do you need me to pick you up something? Okay, well, I'll talk to you again in 2 days. I mean, start small, start to cooperate like that, and it makes a huge difference. You know, I've got people that I call. They're my age. You know, they're getting old, but they got nobody, no family, no friends. They're on a pension. They can't afford anything. You know, they can't turn the heat on in their house. Nobody calls them. I call. How you doing? How you doing, Dave? Yeah, and the truck, you know. It makes all the difference in the world. So start small. Find one other family and talk about things. And then figure out how you can help each other.
Yes. And then build from there. But I think you're right that we are going to need interdependence is going to be a crucial part of surviving if shit does hit the fan. But even with it, even if it doesn't, because people are so atomized nowadays. So this is something that everyone, these are systems and techniques that everyone should be considering. So yeah. Excellent. Okay, let's end it there.
Yep.
It's been an interesting interview. So thank you very much. I'll be back about 10 minutes with Aidan Paladin. In the meantime, Stefan Verstappen, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2025.
Thank you for having me, Colin.
All right.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. How about helping your tireless host? T-shirts, mugs, and posters are available in the merchandise store. The perfect way to remember this unique time. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the fire burning.